Planning Commission. First order of business is roll call. Jim Patrick, here. Bill Rannigan?
Here.
Bob Berman?
Here.
Jim Hanselman?
Here.
Gary East?
Here.
Braulio Escobar? You're muted.
Braulio, you got to say something.
Here.
Okay.
Here.
And John Updike?
Here.
Okay.
Take the earbuds out.
I just unmuted.
Okay, first up is approval of the minutes, approval of the Planning Commission regular session meeting minutes of December 12th, 2022.
I read through the meeting minutes. They were very long and extensive. you know, I sped read. I think it took me a minute.
Nonetheless, it was good of you.
And there was no corrections to be made, so I would recommend we go forward and approve the meeting minutes.
Okay.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, saying nay. Motion carries. All right, anyone wishing to address the commission about anything not on the agenda tonight? Okay. All right, next up is the annual organizational meeting. And I'd like to start it by nominating Bill Rannigan as chair.
I'd like to second that.
You feel trapped yet?
Do I get a rebuttal?
Any other nominations for chair? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries. And I'll let you nominate your own vice chair.
Okay, second part of the organizational meeting is the vice chair. Do we have anybody who would like to be the vice chair? Bob Berman raises his hand. Braulio, are you interested?
Well, I'm not even there.
So what?
And I would defer to those with more experience on the committee, to be fair.
Okay. We have Mr. Berman as the nominee. Are there any discussion items regarding it? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, Bob is the new vice chair of the Planning Commission.
Jeremy, you now.
Okay, I gotta get my.
Chair Rannigan, can I get a confirmation on who seconded that vice chair nomination?
I think it was Gary.
Nobody did. I volunteered.
Oh, you volunteered. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think anybody did. Yeah,
no. I will if you need one. So. Yeah.
You could hear us arguing over it.
Get your one of these?
Oh, I have one, but this is a better one.
He's got another one over there, too.
Go ahead. I got an old one.
Doesn't hurt to have two. I've lost
you're
that
right.
thing
I need to.
Several times.
This public hearing is being conducted utilizing the Zoom video conference platform. Before we get started, I would like to provide staff a moment to identify individuals that are participating virtually.
So there is a Byron Balow from LRS Architects, Paul Kurth from LRS Architects, and Commissioner Escobar is also participating. And that is everybody on Zoom.
Ah, thank you. Before we move on, we'd like to cover a few ground rules. Individuals wishing to speak may raise their hand or use the raise hand feature on Zoom, which can be found by clicking on the participants button on the bottom of a computer screen or on the bottom of a smartphone or by dialing 9 on a landline. I will call out the order of testimony in cases where multiple hands are raised. Please keep your microphone muted unless you are speaking. Press star 6 to mute and unmute if you're using a landline. For persons participating by video or phone, the city can make the shared screen feature available for those that wish to make a presentation. Information shared with the Planning Commission in this manner is part of the record, and a copy of the materials will need to be provided to staff. For those who are attending in person, a computer has been set up, which is up here in the front, so that they may provide testimony using the video conference platform. For quasi-legislative land use public hearings, the public hearing we're going to hear is the annexation of some property in South Beach into the city. So I have to read a statement regarding that.
Chair, and just for the record, there's also a conditional use permit that's up for public hearing with Toyota of Newport.
Ah, you're right. The statement applies to quasi-judicial and legislative land use hearings on the agenda. All testimony and evidence presented toward the request being heard must be directed toward the applicable criteria and the Newport Comprehensive Plan, Newport Municipal Code, or other land use regulations or standards which the speaker believes to apply to the decision. The failure of anyone to raise an issue accompanied by statements or evidence sufficient to afford the Planning Commission and the parties an opportunity to respond to the issue will preclude appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals, which is called LUBA, based on that issue. An issue which may be the basis for an appeal to LUBA shall be raised not later than the close of the record at or following this evidentiary hearing. Such issues shall be raised and accompanied by statements or evidence sufficient to afford the city decision makers and the parties an adequate opportunity to respond to each issue. The failure of the applicant to raise constitutional or other issues relating to proposed conditions of approval with sufficient specificity to allow the city to respond to the issue precludes an action for damages in circuit court. Prior to the conclusion of a hearing, any participant may request an opportunity to present additional evidence, arguments, or testimony regarding the application. If such a request is made, then the hearing will be continued to a date certain and schedule set for submittal of additional testimony, a period for parties to respond to the new testimony, and a period whereby the applicant can provide final argument. At this time, I would ask planning commissioners to disclose any actual or potential conflicts of interest, bias, ex parte contacts, or site visits for any items that are on the agenda.
I did a site visit both at the car dealership, also at the South Beach Church property.
Very good.
Third one about the building that Moe's bought.
Down on the Bayfront.
I made site visits to those three.
Okay. I did site visits at the Toyota, the Newport Toyota dealer, and the bazaar down on Bayfront at Moe's.
The Grand.
Any other?
No site visits for me, but I've been by each of the three at various times.
I'm sure you have.
Same for me.
Yep, same for me.
Okay. If anyone present has an objection to the participant of any planning commission member or the commission as a whole, please raise that objection now. I do not hear any. Okay. The planning commission may, at the request of a participant or on its own accord, continue the hearing to a date certain to provide an opportunity for persons to present and rebut new evidence, arguments, or testimony related to the applicable criteria. Hearing will proceed in the following order: staff report, applicant's testimony, persons in favor, persons opposed, the applicant's rebuttal, The record closes for public testimony, the Planning Commission deliberation, questions, and verbal decision. A final order and findings will be prepared for consideration at the next meeting. Okay, at this time, I believe, do we have any action items other than what's on the agenda?
No, there are no action items outside the organizational meeting, which you've already taken care of.
Okay. First up is file 4-CUP-22. Conditional use permit for the Toyota of Newport dealership / service building. And director comments?
Yes, Derek Tokos, Community Development Director. I'll go ahead and go through the staff report. On this application, as it's a conditional use permit, the Planning Commission is the decision-making authority. Therefore, at the end of this hearing, you have the option of making a motion to approve or deny. Our recommendation is that you move forward with a motion for approval, in which case that would be followed with a final order and findings 2 weeks out at your next meeting. The other item, the annexation, you're making a recommendation to the City Council, so it's a little bit different. So with this conditional use application, this is for a new Toyota dealership in South Beach on the site of where the existing Toyota dealership is located. It'll be about 26,000 square feet in size. In your packet, you have information illustrating, you know, where the building would be located, what it would look like. It'll be, in addition to auto sales, you'll have vehicle repair. Both of those are conditional uses in the zone. I included the site in the staff report. For conditional uses, there are four pertinent criteria. Before I read them, I'm going to go ahead and put the map up on the big screen so folks can see it. I can get to that. All right, so there's the property. It's situated at the northwest corner of the intersection of Southwest 35th Street and US 101. This is a location where we recently completed some pretty significant highway improvements. We relocated the signal from 32nd up here down to 35th, and we connected that street through. And so that's as it stands now. You don't see all of that on the aerial because the aerial isn't as current in terms of the work. Now, the applicant in this case will be taking out all of the existing buildings, and then that includes the storage buildings down here and this building over here. So all the buildings will go. And the criterion for this conditional use, they're in 14.34.050 of the Newport Municipal Code, and there are four standards that are pertinent. One is that the commission's charged with confirming that public facilities are adequate to support the proposed use, and that we're talking about public facilities, we're talking about water and wastewater service, streets, storm drainage, that kind of thing. The analysis in the staff report establishes that those services exist and are available to serve this property and are sufficient to support development of this property. So you have ample grounds to find that standard has been met. The next has to do with establishing that the particular application satisfies or complies with the requirements of the underlying zone, which in this case is commercial or C1, and any overlay zones that apply. Most of what's pertinent here, almost all of it, frankly, is in relation to the underlying C1 zone and the development standards that apply for development in a C1 zone, and I list those out in the report. They get at parking, lighting, public improvements, that kind of thing. And I'm not going to read all of the recommended conditions, but I'll touch on each. they certainly have the land area here and capacity to address each of these requirements. One has to do with parking. And there, that has to do with the landscaping of the parking area and a requirement that was put in with the last round of code revisions that the city adopted. That's with the transportation system plan, last major one. That requires landscape islands to break up contiguous parking areas where you have more than 12 stalls lined up, that kind of thing. So when you look at the site plan, there are some areas there identified specifically in a staff report where they need to introduce some additional landscaping to break up those parking areas a little bit better. Certainly can be done. They'll still have more than enough parking to meet their needs and then additional parking as they've identified on their site plan for inventory. they'll need to comply with some recent state legislation that deals with electric vehicle charging. I'm sure that was already on their radar, but it's one that we just want to call out to make sure it gets picked up, and that's sizing your electrical service and at a minimum extending conduit out for electric vehicle charging. Lighting, really the language here is you can't have lighting that's going to cast out into nearby residential areas. The closest residential areas are to the northwest. What's right here is actually OMSI's Camp Grace. It's a little further to the north. So as long as they shield their lighting, they should be fine. And it's just that they need to provide some information to that effect, which can be done. It wasn't clear in their application whether or not they were doing designated employee parking. If they are, we now have a requirement that they provide preferential vanpool or carpool spaces if they're designating employee parking, and that was part of the same package of changes that happened when we did the transportation system plan. I'm sure they can speak to that as part of their presentation. ODOT had inquired about whether or not a separated bike lane would be, whether or not the city would require the applicant to put in a separated bike lane along US 101, because that's what's called for in the transportation system plan. We just completed the improvements along with a striped kind of standard bike lane in there. We're not asking that they change that at this point in time. That kind of improvement, something we would look to do corridor-wide, not with just a specific property along the highway. But they will need to do a non-remonstrance agreement to indicate that they would participate in a local improvement district to do that type of improvement if one's ever formed. I think it's unlikely that we would form a local improvement district for something like that, but that's kind of the default if they're not doing the improvement. One area where they do need to do some improvements is there's a little bit of sidewalk that they'll need to add on the north side of 35th. That was not done as part of our project on the north side beyond, basically the immediate intersection area. And so they'll have a little bit of sidewalk they need to put in over here. That's about it. I think there's another recommendation in there relating to a sign permit and some signage area that'll need to be clarified. That can be clarified through the sign permitting process. The last two criteria, no adverse impacts on nearby property, greater than existing use. And again, the existing use is already an auto dealership. So you would factor in the existing impact and activity on this property. It's not like they're developing a vacant property. It's already an auto dealership. It's going to be newer, nicer, a little bit bigger. But it really has no greater adverse impact relative to the existing use. And you have ample information in there to find that standard's met. And the last one has to do with the building being consistent with the development character of the area, particularly with respect to size and height. As proposed, that's a pretty large building, but it's not uncommon in South Beach for us to have large buildings. You can look at Rogue Breweries just a little bit further to the north, various manufacturing components to that building, and then you've got the whole Hatfield campus. The MSI building's rather large. Oregon Coast Aquarium just to the northeast, again, large buildings. So it's not uncommon for there to be relatively large buildings in this area. So there's, again, sufficient information for you to find that standard's met. So our recommendation to staff would be for you to go ahead and find that the standards have been met, subject to the applicant addressing the conditions we've outlined in our report. And again, those I just brought that plan up too, just so you could again see it. This is what they had submitted in terms of the footprint of the building, kind of layout of their parking areas, dedicated parking more or less here, inventory parking here, and then to the west, and a brand new building, brand new look in terms of US 101. And landscaping will be introduced too as part of this, as you saw on their plan, between the project and 101, and that was part of what we were trying to accomplish down here, which was to get a little bit more greenscape along the 101 corridor there. So anyhow, do you have any questions of staff?
Bob?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, several things. The easy one first. The vanpool, carpool requirement, mm-hmm. is there a minimum or a number of employees before that kicks in?
I believe there was. Was that not referenced in the staff report?
I didn't see it there. They
were over the threshold. That was a relevant issue.
Okay.
But again, it's only if they designate employee right. spaces, yeah. and that, okay. that wasn't clear. I mean, it showed where employees could park, but it doesn't necessarily mean that their intent right. was to make that exclusively employee parking.
There were some parameters listed.
Yeah.
10% of the, or if you have over 20 spaces.
I think it was over 20, like something like that, yeah.
Now that you say that, next one is just a question for my information. They've already taken care of it. But that 15-foot landscape buffer that we talked about when mm-hmm. we did the rezoning.
Yeah.
That doesn't appear to have ever made it into the municipal code.
Yeah, it's in there. It's in the code.
I downloaded the latest okay. municipal code 2 days ago and it wasn't there.
Okay. All right, whether or not it's fully updated online, I'll double check with the city administration because that's their job. But okay.
I also, you know, looked through the website for that ordinance mm-hmm. and found no reference to it beyond what we did, which was I recommended.
It was adopted. That was all adopted. Yeah. In terms of
their search on the website, then is not great.
Okay.
But it was not in the latest version that you download from the main menu on the mm-hmm. website. Okay. The other thing that maybe requires a little more discussion is this vehicle repair. Now, again, off that version of the municipal code, that's just not allowed. And
it's conditional. It was put in as conditional.
Because it's not in the municipal code that I downloaded.
That was part of that same ordinance you had some difficulty locating. But it became a conditional use.
Okay.
And they actually waited until that ordinance was adopted before they submitted their application. Because these issues were pertinent to them.
Right. Okay. Well, if that's the case, then mm-hmm. please get somebody.
I'll talk to Peggy and Eric, the city manager's office, to figure out where they're at with that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. John?
Quick question about landscaping. Are there details of the landscaping that get worked out at a later date then, or is it just sort of shows a strip with really no reference to what goes into the, particularly the facade landscaping along the 101?
They'll provide some additional details with their building plan sets that we review. And site plan, just so we can confirm exactly all the landscaping hits the bar in terms of what's required by code.
The other questions?
A question or a comment. When it comes to vehicle repair, mm-hmm. are they including a body shop where you have paints, solvents, those kinds of things, or is this just mechanical repair?
I'll defer to them. I'll let them, they can speak to that as part of their presentation.
Okay, all right.
Only once? Okay. At this point, we have the applicant testimony.
I'm gonna go ahead and stop share for now.
So who's speaking for the applicant?
Hi, my name is Paul Kurth. I'm with LRS Architects in Portland. Thank you for having us. Thank you, Derek, for your discussion of our project.
Could you speak a little louder?
Can you hear me now? Is this okay?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Paul Kurth with LRS Architects in Portland. We are representing Jackson Toyota of Newport, and thank you for discussing our project, Derek. As was discussed, this is a showroom and vehicle repair facility that we've designed, and we'd be glad to answer any other questions you might have about it.
I note on some drawings, and it was mentioned previously by the director, designations for parking spaces. The one drawing, perhaps A002, has labeling on it for parking spaces in there, who would use them, customers, service, employees, or otherwise. It would be inventory. So I guess we could get some sense of what you would expect the dealership to do. But I raised the question, and we may not get there an answer yet, with body shop work, because body shops attract wrecks. That's big on their customer list. And I was interested in seeing where the wrecks would be parked, because I don't think you'd be parking them inside. But wrecks are, what should I say? A wreck. So I do have those kinds of issues with the drawings that we have. And I know these are odd lot things. And also wondered where your electrical recharging stations were. I couldn't find them. I'm sure you've got them.
My understanding is there would not be any body shop work or wrecks, as you describe them. This would be mechanical vehicle repairs that occur on vehicle lifts inside the structure.
Thank you.
How about the electrical charging question? That's a good question you asked. Do we know where the electrical charging units are?
Well, he did not. So I perhaps you did not hear my question. I wondered if you have electrical charging stations in the design.
We will have a number of electrical charging locations on the site. I don't believe we have identified particular locations where they are at this time. And I didn't see any requirements for them being in a certain place on the site, but we will have them, and those details will be worked up.
Thank you. No, it's not a requirement. It's just something we'd like to see businesses add into their overall plan. It helps the city. It helps our tourists. It might even draw some rechargers into your showroom. You know, something to help along. And my last remark would be for the architect, Mr. Kurth. Again, it's not a requirement, but it was pointed out that light from your outdoor lighting should stay kind of on site. And that's important. It's important to me. And it's not, again, a regulation, but I'm kind of a fan of dark skies. And you can still do good security and still have dark skies. So thank you for any effort you could spend in that plan. Thank you both.
I have a question. On the electric chargers, you're planning to put in one or two or three? And are they going to be fast chargers or? since Toyota sells electric vehicles nowadays?
I don't have that information on quantity or type. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Other questions of Paul?
No, but I want to point out that it says they have to have 20% of the required parking, which is 44 spaces, so that's roughly either 8 or 9 electrical. And for the van, it's the employee parking. I thought that was 26, so they needed 4 van pool parking spaces.
That must be, I see. I did not recognize that as charging stations the way it was written here.
Yeah.
Electrical service and conduit.
I don't know if they have to put it in or they just have to put the conduit in. I haven't read the code.
So. Yeah, that's why.
It was my understanding they only have to put the conduit in.
That is correct.
For a future installation of charging.
Yeah. They don't have to
put in the charging station. That's just a bonus.
Yeah.
Well, I would hope they'd be forward thinking.
Well, they probably will because they sell several.
They sell those kinds of vehicles.
Okay, other questions? Okay. Do we have, now's the time for any persons who are in favor to speak? I don't hear any. Okay. Persons opposed? I don't hear any opposed, so it's time for the applicant's rebuttal, but since there was nobody opposed, I assume you waive your right to rebuttal. At this point in time, the record is closed for public testimony, and at this time, the Planning Commission will go into deliberation and come up with a verbal decision. Final order and findings will be prepared for the next meeting. So we'll start with Mr. Jim.
Oh, boy. I think they've, dotted their I's, crossed their T's. They need to do a little better explaining on a few things. But I don't find anything major at wrong with their proposal. I just hope they'll be good members of the community and look into some of these things. I would support this.
Mr. Patrick. You don't get to go last.
No, I get to go near the front for a change. I think they met all the criteria. It's conditional use. That covers the vehicle repair stuff. The conditions are reasonable as long as they fulfill them. And I think it'll be an improvement to the South Beach area, so.
Bob?
I agree.
Gary?
I agree.
John?
I'll make this easy. I agree as well.
And last but not least, Broglio.
Well, we had a hint that this was going to be coming through when we were addressing the zone changes in South Beach. Some of the older structures are going to be removed. New structure will be built. And as Mr. Patrick said, I think it will enhance South Beach. I fully support this this conditional use application, given that the criteria have been met by the applicant.
Okay, and I think as everybody else said, all conditions have been met. It'll certainly be an improvement in South Beach, and I look forward to a bigger weight room for customers. The old one was pretty bad. so I support the renovation of the dealership.
I'd like to make a motion to approve the application with the 3 conditions in the report.
I second.
Okay. Motion's been made and seconded.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none, the verbal decision has been made. And a final order and findings will be prepared for the consideration at the next Planning Commission meeting.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Next up is file number 3-AX-22/7-Z-22. South Beach Church property annexation and zoning map designation. Staff report.
Yes, again, Derek Tokos, Community Development Director. I'm going to go ahead and bring up another map just so it's up and people can see it. This will full screen mode. So here's the property we're talking about. You have before you a petition to annex just under 12 acres, 11.98 acres of land into the city of Newport. This property is currently inside the city's urban growth boundary, and it's under a high density residential designation, as you can see right there. For annexations, the annexation itself, and then you have to apply zoning because it's coming into the city. For high density residential, that zoning option is either an R3 medium density multifamily or an R4 high density multifamily. This will be coming in with an R3 medium density multifamily. Now, South Beach Church is annexing because they intend to construct a church on the property. Now, in all of our residential zones, churches are conditional uses. So if this annexation is successful, they would then follow and submit a conditional use, which would be noticed, and you would have a separate public hearing on the conditional use application, and it's at that time you would see details about what they intend to construct. But that's not the step you have before you now. Right now you have before you the annexation, and the criteria for annexation are set forth in NMC, or Newport Municipal Code 14.37.040. Have the requisite consents been filed? And there's some statutes that are relevant that I put in my staff report as well. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but can field questions. But have the requisite consents been filed? So in this case, it has been. South Beach Church now owns this property. They've formally asked to come into the city limits. There's a consent form in the materials that meets this test. Is the property inside the urban growth boundary? It is. Our official maps show that it is inside the urban growth boundary and under that high density residential designation. That's been met. Is it contiguous to the current city limits? It is. It's contiguous on the west and to the south. For purposes of an annexation, that bar's been met. For zoning, does this further a public necessity? Is it consistent with the general welfare? Well, this is residential property. It's zoned for residential use principally, but other uses through conditional processes. We have a pretty glaring need for additional residential land inside the city limits. That's in of itself sufficient for you to find that there's a public necessity to bring in this land. Whether or not at the end of the day it's ultimately developed with residents, it's zoned residential, which is really what you're looking at this stage of the game. There is some language in there that deals with compliance with the transportation planning rule. You probably took a look at that when you went through the staff report. But essentially, if a land area has been addressed as part of a formal transportation system plan, and so we have already accounted for it through that process, then there's no need for them to do site-specific transportation analysis. And that's the case here, as I outlined in the staff report. This actually was put into the city's comprehensive inside our UGB before that transportation planning rule existed. So it would be exempt under the transportation planning rule. And there's some language in there that says those types of circumstances, if they're later picked up as part of a transportation system planning process, and we've done that twice, with our 2012 work in South Beach specifically, and then with this recently adopted transportation system plan, we accounted for the anticipated amount of development when setting out the kind of projects we think we're going to need, like signalizing 40th and 101, for example. So there's no need for them to do that kind of analysis at this point in time. And that's what the TPR references, or transportation planning rule references, in my staff report explain, that it's exempt from having to do further analysis under the state administrative rules for those reasons.
Is it still going to be exempt when they come back with a conditional use request?
Correct. Now, that doesn't mean you can't address certain aspects relative to the traffic flow and parking, but it has to relate to the conditional use criteria, not the transportation planning rule. Let's see if there's anything else here that I want to touch on. This pretty straightforward. In your packet, there's some additional information, the actual legal description and boundary survey information that goes along with this. If you provide a favorable recommendation, there's another public hearing that's involved here before the city council. And at that time, they would take up an actual ordinance. And then from there, if it's approved by the council, we then route it up to the Oregon Department of Revenue for them to officially modify their maps. Now, we've already provided this information to the Department of Revenue because they provide for what we call a preliminary review to make sure that they don't have problems with the legal description or boundary map. And so we're almost done with that piece, and we will be done with that piece before this gets to the council in an ordinance format. Any questions of staff?
The public next door, is that the OSU student housing?
On the south side of 40th would be the Oregon State University student housing and or faculty housing in whatever form we eventually see it.
What's the public there?
The public? Over here?
Yeah.
We own that. City owns it. Used to be part of the South Beach Water District. That's the residual land that we still have when that district was subsumed by the city at some point. Those are the assets we have.
Is there any discussion about uses of that?
Well, one thing that this isn't pertinent to your decision here, but
no.
But one thing that we'll be talking to, and we already have to some degree talked to the South Beach Church about, is...
Derek, I lost audio.
Hello? Can you...
I lost your audio feed for a few seconds. Now you're back.
Okay. So the question was any thought to how these public properties might be used in the future? And what we would like to do is extend a public access trail down Chestnut. We actually own this piece here, too. Even though it's not designated public, it is owned by the city. It's a wetland. Is to run a trail down south along the Chestnut right-of-way, and then along with the contour of the land on the slope here through their property, and then eventually loop it back into Wilder this way. It's something we'll talk to them about a little bit later as things move further along. I think they have some interest in seeing what ultimately will be done here too, because it could impact their site. So those will certainly be some discussions to be had.
And is there any involvement on the part of the county in withdrawing land out of the UGB?
Not the county. We do have three districts we withdraw. At the same time as we annex, we withdraw from the county, Lincoln County Library District, the Rural Fire District. Those two, we already provide those services to this area, so it's like a wash. The one, we have that Seal Rock Water District agreement where there's some outstanding debt we have to pay. This was debt that was accrued before we took over responsibility for water service in that area, and it's almost all gone. In fact, I just got the invoice from Seal Rock because I gave them a heads up that this was moving through the process, wanted to know what remaining debt obligation we have to pay off relative to these properties, and it's $22 and change. So it's almost gone. this was some debt that was originally incurred in, I think, about 07, 08, and then they refinanced it in 2013. And so it's starting to go by the wayside, but it's something we technically have to address. But nothing else relative to the county.
What is our policy about annexing landlocked sites?
This one's not landlocked, actually. Technically, it fronts a narrow strip of Chestnut on the west. You just can't see it well because of that red line. This is actually a thin road right-of-way, runs all the way down here. And then they actually have a serviceable public road access right here. There's actually a curb cut when you go up the hill right past the substation there.
Okay.
Other questions of staff? Hearing none, we can now have the applicant's testimony. So who would like to? Anybody like to come up and say a few words in favor?
Have any questions for us?
It'd be helpful if you could just come up to the mic. You can say just what you said, Luke. Yeah, just on the record.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. We're excited about the project. Thank you, Derek, for all the information. You've been helping us along the way.
For the record, since we're recording this, could you state your name and address, please?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Luke Frechette, and my address is 7130 Northeast Benton Place, Newport, Oregon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And we're excited about the long process. It's taken us 9 years to identify this piece of land and finally just put it under contract on November 1st and making preliminary efforts. We've got the geotech surveyors coming out tomorrow at 10 a.m. and digging test pits, making sure it's good to build on. And we're just wanting to get out of the lot that we've been in forever and let you guys do what you need to do with that area. And so we're looking forward to it. Any questions?
What is your overall time frame? I know there's a deadline for getting out of your current property, and it doesn't sound like it's going to be practical to have this completed.
Yeah, that's a good question. We have a couple of contingencies in that scenario. So we're going to be building as fast as possible, and meetings like this that push us forward as quick as possible are going to be advantageous to that. We've got our builders and our design team working all hours of the night to make sure that we have everything ready to go. So as soon as we get all of the approval, building permits, and everything we need, I can't speak necessarily clear, but hopefully within March we're breaking ground and moving forward with our build. Is that aggressive, or does that sound right? March?
As soon as possible.
Yeah, as soon as possible. And then the contingencies I mentioned, if we find ourselves December 31st, which is our deadline to get out of the warehouse, we'll either get out right then and there if there's no other way to extend that stay, if we can apply for a 2-month or 6-month or something like that, depending on the city's need for us to vacate. That will be our first ask. If we have to go, then we'll put all our stuff in storage and we'll have our services in local venues like middle schools, high schools, and we'll just have to go that route for as long as necessary until we complete. So we will be on time no matter what.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you. Any other questions?
Rolio, have any?
Yes, although my question really doesn't address this issue of annexation, but I'm looking at the map and I see that the site that's intended to be annexed into the city is adjacent to high-density residential. What plan do you have to mitigate the noise that was the complaint from your other neighbors at your South Beach parcel?
Our plan is to have everyone living in those high-density areas go to the church. If that plan doesn't work, then we're going to design a building.
That'll be a new ordinance.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to design a building, and we've done that already, that is acoustically sound from the inside and out, and be mindful of those parameters. So it's been a good experiment where we're at in the warehouse that we weren't supposed to be in. So we're planning on making it so it's soundproof, if you would.
I would suggest making the building soundproof might be a better plan than hoping that the high-density residential is occupied by your attendees.
Agreed.
I'm sure they're eager to be a good neighbor.
We are. Yeah, we're excited about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Any other questions of the pastor or the architect or for Gross? Okay, hearing none, are there any other people who'd like to speak in favor of it?
Thank you.
Hearing none, are there anybody who would like to speak in opposition? I don't hear anything, so I assume the applicant will does not need to have a rebuttal to the opposition. So at this point, the record is now closed for public testimony, and the commission will now deliberate, raise questions, and come up with a verbal decision. And what we're deciding is to
recommend
to the city council the annexation of the property into the city. So we'll start with John Updike.
That John, okay, thank you. I find no problems with the submittal, so I'm certainly in favor of tendering a favorable recommendation.
Yeah, and I agree.
Yeah, it seems like a logical thing to do.
Quick.
I agree too, and I think in R3, I believe it's R3 all around it, so across the street is R3 too, so
right.
that zoning fits. And there's not a whole lot of difference between R3 and R4, to tell you the truth. But.
No. Mr. Jim?
I'm fine with everything. I think this is the way to do it, annex it and put the zoning on it, and it'll be good. I'm only confused by that second person that was up here that looked kind of familiar.
They didn't have a Hawaiian shirt on.
I mean, gussied up, you know.
They look presentable.
Yeah.
Except for the beard, of course.
I'm all for it. I don't see any issues whatsoever. And so could I get a motion to?
I'm gonna get all my motions out. I'm like,
go ahead.
Well, yeah,
this is your last shot.
I know. I'm gonna get to make some motions first. I'd like to move we forward this recommendation for annexation to the city council along with an R3 zoning designation.
Second.
Okay. Motion's been made and been seconded. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carried. We will now come up with something that'll go to the city council.
Right. This will be scheduled with the city council. We'll put together an ordinance with the final legal description. There'll be a second public hearing before the city council. If they adopt that ordinance, then the annexation's been authorized, and we just route it through the state and county to make it all happen.
Okay. We have a third one now. And the third, let me see. I lost my place. Annexation. File 5Z-. No.
Yep.
No.
Yep,
we have one before that.
No, we did these two.
Yeah, we have.
Now we're to the short term.
Yeah, you have the right one, the 5Z. Right.
Yeah, okay. 5Z-22 public hearing. On draft ordinance number 2202, short term rental work group recommendation. Staff?
Thank you. And you've had a chance to kind of consider this in the past. And of all folks, given your role in the adoption of the original ordinance 2144, you certainly have some context in terms of how we've gotten to where we are right now. But what you have is a series of kind of targeted changes that were recommended by a short-term rental ordinance implementation work group that was impaneled after we adopted Ordinance 2144 on May of 2019. And so they met on a quarterly basis between 2019 and 2022, just wanting to make sure that the ordinance was working as it should. And by and large, they feel that it is. However, there are some areas that they felt could be clarified as part of the with code changes. And those include really four areas: the grace period provision. This applies or would apply only to those circumstances where somebody is selling a transferable unit, which would be in your C2 tourist commercial areas or immediately adjacent to a C2 tourist commercial. And the reasoning there is, and it's a 30-day grace period, and it's because, you know, these units that are transferable, they're buying them, and in most cases, those units are booked out for months with guests, and it just happens to be an ownership change at that point in time, and it just provides continuity. They don't have to ask people to reschedule, things of that nature. Then there's the codification of the actual administrative rules that we put together for handling the wait list. That was never really fully fleshed out with the original ordinance, but we have since, through multiple iterations of going through wait list work. And so when I'm talking about the wait list, again, we have a short-term rental ordinance that presently caps the number of licenses available for vacation rental dwellings, which is one of our three types of short-term rentals, to 176 within the area where they're permitted. And we've been at that cap since shortly after the ordinance was adopted. And so we've gone through a few cycles now of the renewal period where licenses that are given up for various reasons, and they are given up for various reasons, are then reallocated based on where people are on the wait list, and we just work through the wait list. But codifying those processes was something that the short-term rental work group felt would be appropriate. There's some language that tightens up regarding code violations, where if you violate provisions of the city's code that are unrelated to your short-term rental use but are on the same property where you're conducting the short-term rental use, then that would count as a strike. The expectation is that if you're operating a licensed short-term rental, you're not only operating in conformance with the short-term rental rules but all of the city's rules while that's operating. And so they felt that was an appropriate piece to add. And then they felt that it made more sense to them to just go ahead and lock in the 176 by ordinance in terms of the license cap, as opposed to that number being set by resolution as long as it doesn't exceed 200, which is what the current code said. So the current code gives the council the flexibility by resolution, which they could do at any meeting, to make adjustments up or down as long as the number doesn't exceed 200. The short-term rental work group said they'd like it in an ordinance, because an ordinance process for amendments is something that requires more public involvement. And so if that number is going to change, I think they really felt that that should be done through that type of process where the public can weigh in one way or the other, as opposed to it popping up on some upcoming council agenda and the number changing, even though there was a high-end limit set at 200. So, I mean, those were the four principal areas. You have a copy of their recommendation letter that's included in your packet. You had a chance to talk about this previously, and you felt that the best course of action was if the council initiated the process for amending the code based on what the short-term rental work group recommended, that you would take it straight to public hearing, which is what we've done. Your options tonight are, if you're comfortable with this as it is, you can say you're comfortable with it and send it on up to the city council for a public hearing up there. You also have the option to consider making other changes that the short-term rental work group didn't address in their recommendation. That's certainly your prerogative, in which case it might be best to continue your public hearing and set a work session where we can work through what those changes might look like. There was one public comment that came in. I trust you all had a chance to take a look at it. It came in from Cheryl Connell. And Cheryl's concern, one, had to do with the 30-day grace period and the fact that they would be operating without a license, the new owner, and concerns about how that might impact safety of guests. I would emphasize there, we're not talking about units that haven't been inspected yet by the city. They had already been inspected with the previous owner who's licensed. Those compliance provisions have to be confirmed each time a license is renewed. While that's an entirely legitimate and understandable issue for Ms. Connell to raise, I do think that is somewhat of a mitigating factor. I think it's a little bit different than a unit that has never been inspected because, candidly, new units that have never been used for vacation rental purposes almost invariably have some sort of issue. Inadequate fire egress, things of that nature that have to be resolved before it can be occupied because it wasn't designed for use in a transient manner like a hotel. It was designed for somebody's personal use. However, in these cases, we've already done those inspections with the person who held the license that they're transferring. So there's some degree of mitigating that safety concern there. The other is that she recommends that she posed the 176 license cap largely because it only applies to licenses issued within the permissible area. It does not extend to the 30-some-odd vacation rentals that continue to operate in a non-conforming manner outside the boundary. So I just wanted to make sure that her comments were acknowledged. She had a chance to review her letter and can think about it. That's about all I have to say, unless you have any questions of staff.
The number she quotes here, by implication, different than what you were talking about. Can you tell us exactly where we're at in terms of the cap and the number of operational vacation rentals within the zone?
Well, within the area where vacation rentals are permitted, that's where the cap applies currently. And we've been at 176 basically since the shortly after the ordinance was adopted in 2019. Each year we have somewhere in the mid-20s, typically, licenses that are freed up that we can then make available to individuals who are on the wait list. We were about 80 something on the wait list at one point, but with these recent ones, we've knocked it down quite a bit. We're in about 40, 50 range.
Yes, that sounds right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, each year it's going to do that up and down as we work through the wait list. And we generally advise folks, you can expect at least 3 years on the wait list before you'll have an opportunity to obtain a license.
What have we seen happen outside the overlay?
Slow attrition as those go away over time. I think we started when the ordinance was adopted, we were in the mid-40s, and now we're down and around the mid-30s in terms of licensed units outside that. So you've slowly started, which is what you would expect over time, those non-conforming vacation rentals outside the boundary would slowly go away as people either choose to no longer offer them for vacation rental purposes or they sell their property. So that's what you've seen. Sometimes they transition it to a long-term, month-to-month kind of rental arrangement, or other times properties are sold. Or they just no longer want to do it because it doesn't work for them.
Okay.
Is there any...
I'd like to suggest...
Go ahead, brother.
Okay. I'd like to suggest that we defer any discussion on this and have a work session. My instinct is I'm not truly in favor of a period of time where a person is operating without a license. And I'd like a little bit more time to think through the issues of the overlay and the hard cap. And so I would suggest a work session on this, maybe at our next meeting.
Okay, Bob, you had something?
I'm just wondering on that topic of grace period. What is the parallel situation, Derek, with respect to a motel?
Well, a motel would continue to operate through that same transitional period, and people would still have to have, we're not going to shut them down between ownership changes. Heck, half the time we don't even know the ownership change happened.
New owner is not required to get a
They have to get a business license, but and they do get a business license, but they operate for a period of time without one. That happens.
And do motels have the kind of inspection requirements that we have in this ordinance?
A little bit different, but our fire department goes through the hotels, motels on kind of a scheduled basis, and so it's whether or not they pop up on a scheduled review. I don't know off the top of my head how frequently they're going through them. That sometimes depends on what their available staffing situation is.
So it's not exactly a parallel situation.
Not exactly, but to your question about could a hotel or motel be operating without a business license, yes, that can happen and has happened. It's part of that transition, but that is expected to be resolved pretty quickly. And they're not supposed to be doing that, but that does happen.
Okay, well, I for one would like to see us revisit the 10-year phase outside the zone, and I think a work session would be appropriate place to take a look at the potential and look at the pluses and minuses of that and see whether we want to consider including that in the changes recommended to the City Council.
Is that part of the Planning Commission, or is that
Derek mentioned that we could
You're the Planning Commission. You have the right to do that. Now, I think it would be very important to make it very clear that that's not a recommendation from the short-term rental work group. They did not go there.
Right.
If anything that comes in outside of this that's something from the Planning Commission, I think we need to be very clear this coming from the Planning Commission.
Sure. Derek, did that issue come up at all and was just... There was a decision not to discuss it?
That has come up, absolutely. And I think the short-term rental, and Bill, jump in if you think I get anything wrong here, but felt that it's working as it was intended, which was it will slowly go away. There is no need for a hard phase-out, that through attrition over time, that number will continue to go down and down and down.
Right. Serving on that subcommittee, Derek is correct. I mean, we have discussed it, and we've discussed it several times, and that committee said it's working fine. We don't need to go in and do a lot of changes. However, Brolio, what is it that you wanted to do now? You wanted a work session for?
I wanted to discuss this concept of the period of time where the a new potential owner would be operating without a license. I'm uncomfortable with folks operating without a license.
Okay. I thought I also, you did not say anything about the number of short-term rentals needed to be revisited, did you?
Well, I got to fair with you. I kind of agree with you that things are better today than they were 4 years ago in terms of the short-term rentals. So to that extent, the ordinance is favorably impacting our community.
Okay.
I would support a workshop along the lines of what Braulio has mentioned, but also what Bob mentioned. I think the phase out is something that was more or less suggested to the community would happen. The City Council used COVID, as did many people, as an excuse not to, although we have not seen any changes in the rental rates through COVID or before COVID. People are still renting these places, so we still have the same kind of traffic is what I'm suggesting. So, I, you know, maybe the phase out outside, maybe the loss of VRDs, STRs outside the overlay is occurring, but the rate doesn't necessarily stay constant, and it doesn't meet what I think much of the community is asking for. And a period of time would help that happen. If we go with as it is, then they may never disappear. There's no guarantee that they will all disappear. So I would like to at least talk about that.
Okay.
And Derek, perhaps you could, invite the some members of the short-term rental committee to participate in the work session.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as you see in my staff report, if that's where you want to go with it, then you have some dates that I put in the staff report. If you want to go the work session route, my advice would then be to continue the public hearing to February 13th so that you could have the work session on the 23rd of January. So again, it's up to you how you want to proceed.
Does that require a motion?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I'd like to move that we continue the public hearing on file 5-Z-22 to the date just specified by Derek. I don't remember in February.
That'd be February 13th, 2023 at 7 p.m.
Okay. In the interim, at our next meeting, have a work session to discuss all of the potential changes.
I second the motion.
Okay. All in favor of having the motion that Bob put forth, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay? Nay. The motion carries.
Derek, is it appropriate to ask you to draft some language to implement a 10-year phase-out outside the zone?
I can bring that. I think we're going to need to, if you're going to entertain something that, as you know, that's a pretty significant issue.
Yep.
Was at the time, was in front of the council. That begs a much more involved public process. That's not something that skates through on, you know, with a limited number of folks who've actually engaged. And so, yeah, I can certainly bring that, but I would expect that you're going to want to talk at a work session then about backing this out and doing a more robust public process.
Okay, well, come up with something and we'll talk about it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Otherwise, people will say, I never knew this was being discussed. I never received notice that this was being discussed.
That's fine.
How did this get back out here?
But I'd like to, I think it's time to bring it up again. I think the last time it was brought up at council was way premature. Mona and their crowd brought it up about 6 months after the ordinance went into effect. And city council didn't even want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe now is time. So let's see where we go with that.
Okay. New business. Next.
Yeah. That would be the 1886 building that I'd like to talk to you about.
Yeah, discussion now is the 1886 building, city limitations on the demolition of historic structures.
Right. You know, this is an issue where we find ourselves in a spot where the previous owner hadn't really done a lot of ongoing maintenance on that building. And it had deteriorated to the point where we received complaints and a complaint from neighboring property owner about the condition and its potential impact on them because, you know, as you know, down on the bayfront, these buildings are all, you know, right next to each other. And so our building official inspected the unit and in March of 2022 outlined a number of issues that led to his determination that it's a dangerous building, that these are significant enough structural problems that they need to be immediately remedied and had outlined a schedule for that. Unfortunately, the owner at that time passed away, and it ended up into an estate. And so there were periods of time there when that transition happened, then the estate's lawyers contacted us. And, you know, we provided them some additional time to get an engineer in there to inspect the structure. The engineer went in there and ultimately determined that the structure is not an imminent risk of failure, but there were plenty of caveats that go along with that in the report, in that, you know, this is based on what we could see. We couldn't see everything. We think there's more problems and things that we couldn't see. We really think a whole series of repairs really need to be done, and they outlined those repairs in their letter, and that was June of 22. And then, you know, the estate comes back and says, okay, well, you know, we're selling it. And so the property sold, that transaction concluded in October, and Moe's bought it. Moe's owns business immediately adjacent to it. They had an option to purchase that the prior owner had given them. I don't know the details on it, but anyway, it doesn't really matter. They bought it. And they took a look at what they needed to do and came to the conclusion that they can't cost effectively remedy the, you know, the situation given how bad the deterioration is at this point in time. And so what they want to do is demolish it and rebuild at that location, and the new building would be consistent with the architectural character of the area, so on and so forth. You would see that through a conditional use, as many of you probably know anyway, because it's a W-2 zone. A new development of that nature would go before you anyway. But so they pull a demolition permit, which is something we do typically just over the counter, to demo the whole thing, and they pull that in December, I think it was the 14th. And at that point, it's like, oh, hey, stop the press. This is one of 16 historic buildings we actually have in our inventory that's protected and has to go to Planning Commission for any alteration that would change its historic character. And by the way, nothing in our code allows for you to make a determination that it can be demoed. And so, and at that point, they had already scheduled for asbestos abatement and would have taken a pretty significant penalty if they couldn't proceed with that work. Fortunately, I was able to help them out with that because the code says that they can, you can do a repair, and that doesn't even require Planning Commission review. And so pulling off the asbestos siding doesn't preclude that from being an in-kind repair. It's just like the first part of a repair, so we could allow that piece to go through. The interior asbestos work really isn't something you'd see anyway, because your review is limited to really the exterior of these buildings. So my question to you, having gone through all that and having had spelled it all out in my staff report, which took a while, would you be inclined to, I see a couple of paths forward that could happen if you're inclined to do it. One would be that we go ahead and just take it off the list, given how bad it's deteriorated. And that would require an amendment to the comprehensive plan to take that 16th structure, the grand, off the list. It's only in a local inventory. I do need to be clear about that. I put it in the staff report. This is not a building that's on a national register. It's not protected by the state through the State Historic Preservation Office. It's simply a local matter. We did confirm that. So one path forward would be to just take it off the list. If it's no longer historic, they would be free to demo it. And then take a little bit more time to work through whether or not you want to make changes to the code itself, or to just dive in and say, hey, look, let's make some changes to the code itself that would allow for demolition in certain circumstances. Now, I provided you 4 sample codes. There are plenty more. That's all I could do given the limited time I had. Salem, Bend, Astoria, and McMinnville. And you'll see in there, there's language about, you know, demolition. I think there's a general recognition that you need to have an out clause for demolition in certain circumstances, and you can set the parameters, but there should be a path for demolition in certain circumstances. And you can see, I think even Salem tried to get at, hey, you can't intentionally not maintain a building to avoid, to find a way to end around the code. And they tried to kind of beef up their nuisance code in that regard. I'm not sure how well that's worked for them. Again, I haven't had a chance to talk to these other jurisdictions. But what I do know is we have a building that's in very poor condition down there. It could quite, you know, easily get to a point where it is a legitimate, you know, at risk of failure and people could get hurt. You know, the estate shut that down, so there's nobody in the building. It's not available for retail use or anything like that. Hasn't been since that point in time. And yes, there was an engineer in the summer who said, you know, hey, it's not an imminent risk now, but you know, these are serious issues that need to be dealt with. And to their credit, folks at, you know, at Moe's have taken a hard look at what they can do here. They just $2 million to rectify that kind of stuff's a big, big, steep cost. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that you're looking at years of deferred maintenance that led to the building getting into the condition it is. Also, you probably caught in the engineering evaluation that the building is probably not, is at least in their opinion, is not even on a foundation. I mean, this is something that was lifted from a location elsewhere and placed on this site. And so you've got that and what that's done in terms of compromising the building's structural integrity too. So anyway, their hope, because they kind of feel stuck here. They bought this. They bought it intentionally to rectify the situation, in part to protect their own investment, because they're building, you know, their operations right next door. And I'm sure they view it as a business opportunity, or they wouldn't have gone down this path. But that said, they want to move forward. They just don't see a viable option with remodeling it. They really see demo as the way to go. I think they'd probably be open to certainly, you know, coordinating with the Historic Society on any documentation they want. If there's any pieces of this that are relevant, I'm sure they'd be willing to talk to them about that, or even incorporate some significant element in their redesign. But they just don't see a viable path forward with dealing with the potpourri of problems that exist with this particular structure.
Yeah, I know this is where we're at today and we have to address it, but were there any provisions in our code having to do with historical structures that, had there been proper enforcement over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, we wouldn't be here?
Nah, nothing that I saw. I mean, I looked through
there. I didn't look through it. So,
yeah, there's, we do have some limited building maintenance provisions, but in our nuisance code, but they don't really get at this. And while we've had discussions, not specifically in the context of historic buildings, but while we've had discussions about building maintenance generally with the city council as to whether or not they want to go down that path, that is a level of resource investment that they've not been prepared to or have the desire to do. Because if you get into building maintenance, largely habitability of multifamily rentals, that kind of thing, that's a whole level of staffing that they just, you know, that's not a step they've been prepared to do.
Well, what's to keep this from happening again, I guess, is really the question. And is that something we should look at in terms of an amendment to the Historic Structures Code to somehow there be periodic inspections with, you know, consequences for not fixing things from one year to the next or something? I'm just spitballing.
Right, I'm not sure what that might look like or how effective those that have gone down that path have found that approach to be, like Salem. My thought is maybe the most effective thing would be to do a two-step here. Take it off the historic list to deal with the immediate situation with this immediate building, and it's specific to this immediate building. That has to go through the conditional use modification. But then initiate some work on the historic and take a little bit more time on that to kind of sort through, okay, with the remaining 15 or others that we want to add, or what, you know, or at least create a process for that to happen. You know, this is all the original inventory work that was done, you know, in the 1880s, you know, so yeah, it's not an area that's received a lot of attention, and it was largely a kind of a hands-off, kind of a limited approach to it in the first place, and that's why you don't have language to deal with maintenance, because I don't think they wanted to deal with maintenance at the time. It was a big lift for them to get the 16 sites designated. You know.
Well, we know that Sylvia Beach is doing a great job about.
Sure. Ernest Block, you had that come before you too, with the Baptist Church.
Yeah. Some have. But you know, on the other, I looked at the list that you included. Jump Off Joe's still listed. I mean, how much attention does this list get?
Right.
You know, and another one described in our packet is owned by maybe a doctor, and he's changed the character of the structure entirely through renovations and stuff, and yet. What's historic about it? I don't know.
You've had three go before you that I can recall. You had the castle that you looked at one point.
Yeah.
You had Sylvia Beach, I think, twice.
Yeah.
And then you've had the Ernest Block. So for that being such a small list, it still managed to get from you a few times.
How many of those are on the state
list? I don't know. I could get that information for you, John. I don't know off the top of my head. I do believe the castle actually was at least inventoried at some point. But some of that stuff changes over time depending on who's owning it and what their objective is.
Yeah. I mean, in my head, I'm sort of struggling between the tension of rewarding demolition by neglect. So we want to be very careful of the action we take in this case and how precedential it could be for other similar ideas owners might get versus the immediate issue that we have here. So, I'd certainly like to see some protections. I can probably provide you some code language from Tucson that I found helpful. We have...
See, that's what I think
a two-step that we needed to protect, and so it's pretty robust language that might be helpful as you try to draft something.
Could we maybe focus on the request from Moe's Enterprises to remove this one specific structure as a historically designated building, and then all these other issues folks want to talk about can be considered in the future. Moe's has been a good citizen in this community, and if we read Mr. McEntee's letter, it's their intention to try to preserve that type of skyline adjacent to their existing building. And so I guess I'd move at this point, and I hope somebody would second it, to allow the removal of the 1886 building from the city's historic inventory designation.
And so that motion would then mean give me a green light to prepare amendments to the comprehensive plan to do just that.
Just that one thing.
I got to send the 35-day notice to DLCD because we're touching the comprehensive plan text, and then you'd have a hearing, and then the council would have a hearing, and an ordinance would ultimately be adopted. Those are the steps we have to follow.
In order to allow Moe's to demolish the building that's falling down or in disrepair, we have to also amend the city's comprehensive plan?
We have to amend the inventory and take it off the list.
Yeah.
Now, we can set it up, and I told Celeste this. I think we could justify an emergency ordinance adoption with the council because of the condition of the building, so that would save a little bit of time. But still two public hearings. You may very well have testimony from folks who don't want to see it demolished. You don't know that until you actually have the public hearing. It is a historic structure.
The other thing that troubles me, though, is if we go down the path of also creating an exit ramp for situations like this in the future in the code, I didn't see the letter as being a robust financial analysis of building new versus rehabbing old. I saw a $1 million range of costs that we don't have any backup, so I'm going on faith.
I hear you.
It's in a letter, right? It's $1 million to $2
million. Yeah. They're not going to build a new building for $100,000, no matter what they say in that letter.
So at $1.5 million, that's $250 a foot. I mean... Yeah, so what's the new construction cost?
It's over 300.
$250, $300, $350.
You know, it's
and that's residential. That's not commercial. Commercial's probably higher. And then you've also got the problem with this particular building trying to build, do anything to rehab that thing, you can't get to that wall. The wall that's rotten, you can't get to it. You have to build it backwards. Good luck.
And I don't disagree with that, but the robustness of the analysis should be a little greater than what we have to date. And so I feel like we're sort of saying, yeah, that's all we need. Somebody just saying, here's a number.
Well, it's too expensive. Yeah, but I think when we build the ordinance, we build that stuff into it. Exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
We're just going to give them an emergency order. Because we didn't have anything in there about telling them to maintain the building, so they just let it collapse. Now you're at a point where I'm with them. I mean, I looked at what the engineer said and went, I'd be taking this thing down, or I'd just walk away from it. Let it be the city's problem.
But then,
literally, it would be cheaper for them to walk away from it than probably try to rehab that building. Well, I don't know how much they paid for it, but I'd be willing to bet you that'd be their choice.
I think just north of $400,000 was the purchase price, if I saw the public records correctly.
How much?
$446,000.
Yeah, for that kind of money, yeah, I'd walk
away. $500,000.
Yeah,
they have to, like anybody who purchases a building that is in a state of decay. And may not be something that can be rehabbed, you still, as a buyer, end up buying what the seller perceives as the value of the building.
That's right.
So you're kind of strapped with that. It's not an unreasonable request to you know, I could certainly talk to the McEntees about if you initiate the process to amend this on the comp plan level, that before your public hearing where you'd need to make a decision,
right,
you could have some additional info. This has just been moving too fast. Right. We're in the holidays.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. I just want to avoid a precedent of knee-jerk reaction to very limited info.
I get what you're saying. I think we need to build that into the code. Yeah. The problem is, if we go down that road first, we're talking
We could be parallel paths here, as you explained.
A couple things. You could, on their specific 1886 building issue, I could talk to them about providing a little bit more detail as to the problems with the structure and why they feel that's really the only viable path forward, so that you have it for the hearing on whether or not to delist the property. But then you could also, on a parallel path, one that would probably take a little bit more time, do a little bit more in-depth look at how should we restructure this historic review process, creating a safety valve for allowing demolition in certain circumstances, but also making sure there's no incentive for somebody to not maintain buildings and things of that nature. And so that piece would take more time, because we need to kind of work through what those options are. So I think that's where I say parallel. You could address the immediate one with the delisting, still get more info on why this structure can't be rehabbed, but then take a longer path to rework the historic code.
And I'd also want to do a survey of what's out there right now. I want to know what kind of shape. The only two that we know about is the blockhouse and Sylvia Beach.
Right, but if we don't do something,
Lighthouse is probably okay.
Yeah, it's okay too.
But I mean, if we don't do something with the 1887, I seriously doubt if there's any fire suppression.
No, they could get hammered. They start on that thing, you demolish enough of it, you're past the 50%. Now you got to bring it all up to code, or you've got a house or a building that's really not up to code.
Right.
The idea of trying to get a foundation underneath that thing and then building a wall you can't get to backwards.
Right.
I mean, you can do anything. With enough money, you can do anything. But it's going to be a lot of money.
Well, otherwise, it'll turn into the old Abbey Hotel.
Well, in the current circumstances, too, just
that
so you know.
Ended up with. Aren't we right back to my same scenario?
Fire department has put together a plan to, because they're not going to go into that building if something happens with that building, given its condition. So they're putting together a plan for responding to protect the rest of the structures that it's adjacent to in the event something happens. Right. So that's where they're at right now.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, Broglio put a motion on to go two-part. One, to modify the comprehensive plan so that this particular structure is delisted and can be demoed, and then to go back take a look at the historic codes that we have and see what needs to be done to beef them up to prevent future similar circumstances, and potentially make sure that owners of historic properties properly maintain them.
Yeah, well, some of this would never have come to light if the buyer had been more meticulous in their purchasing. I mean, you should know what you're buying.
Yeah.
You know, but that those things happen. You know, we can't keep.
We don't know whether they had an inspection before they purchased it.
Well, I want to be clear. With respect to the McEntees purchasing this from the estate of Mr. Welton, they knew this was a problem. They were acquiring it in part to address the problem because of the risk it poses to their own investments adjacent to it.
They probably didn't understand the historical significance. That's what
they didn't know.
Because that might have changed their approach. That's what I was suggesting a moment ago.
Yeah.
And if we do that, there's no way for us to put a condition on it. They build something similar.
You have the conditional use review process on the bayfront where you can weigh in on that. Is it consistent with the development character of the area relative to its size and height? Those are areas where you can weigh in a little bit on that.
Okay. Isn't that thing really pushing our height limit too? Or is it in a commercial zone 50 foot?
Well, no, remember it's W2, so you're 35 feet. I don't know what its building height is. You know, it's got to be pushing
it
probably.
I think it's
over
35.
But yeah, but it was 1886.
Yeah.
Okay, so Broglio has come forth with the motion. Is there a second on Broglio's motion?
I'll second Broglio.
Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay. Any oppositions? I didn't hear any. Okay. Motion carries.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and get that notice with the state and get a public hearing scheduled.
Okay. Derek, unfinished business.
I think all I have is an updated work program that I included in here. I had placeholders for the SDR stuff in there, probably saw, so I'll just continue to give you updates on the work program as it evolves. And we'll have a goal setting session come up here pretty soon where we can talk about some of the other stuff.
Okay. Going once, going twice. Adjourned.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.